we are always losing and finding our place in the world.
That's really why I call the book On Losing and Finding Home, not that one ever arrives, but that it's a cyclical way that we live.
Ah, so not on losing home and finding home, but on losing and finding home.
Exactly, exactly. I do think it's a cycle that we all go through, you know, feeling unmoored, feeling moored. And sometimes we think, you know, we've reached the pinnacle of whatever happiness, and then something happens and the rug gets kicked out from under us and we start again.
That's Catherine Hankla. We talk with her about her memoir, Lost Places, On Losing and Finding Home. Then we have a short reading of something I wrote about finding home. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Home is where the heart is, goes the saying. It's also where memory resides, our connection to our past, our family and friends, our identity. So what happens when you lose your home? Do you lose your memory? Or can you also gain something, your freedom? Catherine Hankla explores this and other questions about the meaning of place in her memoir, Lost Places, On Losing and Finding Home. Her definitions of home are located not just in geography, but also in history, our physical bodies, and the roles we play for those we love. The essays in her book are written with a poet's sensibility, for Hankla is a poet. In a voice both droll and lyrical, she invites us to seek deeper understandings and connections with our own inner landscapes and the earth itself. Catherine Hankla teaches English at Hollins University, where she directs the Jackson Center for Creative Writing. She's been honored with numerous awards, including a Penn Syndicated Fiction Award. Well, Catherine Hankla, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Your book, On Losing and Finding Home, it's a memoir in essays, as you call it. And I found it is almost a kind of flaneur's journey through the concept of home. What are some of the different definitions of home that you explore in this book?
Well, it took me a while to even figure out what I was writing about, because I had some divergent essays going, or at least I thought that they were different from each other. Started out with essays about living in the countryside, and My Life in Snakes is a good example of that drift. And as time went by, I shifted my focus to other places that I was living. And I think that I've kind of mastered the art of moving many times and not going very far. So I finally figured out what I was writing about. And at that point, got a lot more intentional about trying to explore different definitions of home, because echo as in home, we think of the ecology, our home, our earth, our place, our region. And then I got more into thinking about also in an elegiac way that the earth, but also the body itself, because in the latter part of the book, I am exploring the body as home through elder care. That is, I spent about 5 years taking care of my aunt and my mother as they got very, very old, thinking about leaving the body, which led me kind of easily into spiritual definitions of home, because I think for many of us, our spiritual moorings make us feel at home or displace us so that we're not at home. So there are many, many different definitions came into this to explore, but I've found that the subject just opened very naturally for me.
Well, let's go back to where you first called home. As you say, you haven't moved very far from there. You live in Western Virginia, is that right?
Yeah, I do. I live in Roanoke, which marks, I think, the beginning of Western Virginia. It's the biggest town in Western Virginia, about 200,000 people in the area. So Roanoke is kind of a between place. It's located in a bowl, very much like Taos. The proportions are different. The mountains are higher there, but Roanoke is in a bowl surrounded by the Blue Ridge Mountains right at the foot of the Great Valley of Virginia, the Shenandoah Valley. So we're not really in Appalachia, but we kind of mark the beginning of it. But I was born farther southwest in the tri-state area, which was smack dab in the heart of Appalachia.
I lived for about 5 years, not too far from there, in southeastern West Virginia in Monroe County.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which was, you know, really an extraordinary place. One of the few places, I guess, in West Virginia that doesn't have coal, but also one of the poorest counties in the country. So talk a little bit about Appalachia. In fact, you say that the truth is nobody can agree on what Appalachia means or is, and most people don't even know where it is.
That is so true because, you know, West Virginia is the only state that's entirely in Appalachia. Appalachia is parts of 13 states. It's one state entirely, West Virginia, and parts of 13 other states. So we're talking about a mountainous region that runs all the way from like northern Mississippi all the way up beyond New York. So most people identify Appalachia as the South. And it's pretty ironic that they do that if they know anything about it at all, because Appalachia was a Southern resistor. That is, the Appalachia that you think of as the South did not defend the Confederate cause. Most of it dissented from that, and the rest of it that was trapped in it did it with a heavy heart. So it's kind of awkward for Appalachians to fit anywhere. We definitely don't fit with the North because we have funny accents, and we don't fit with the South. So I think most people don't recognize that.
You write about Appalachia. You write about it as a place of a natural disaster, about coal. I mean, where I lived, there wasn't coal, but coal has been a place that profoundly has transformed the home of the original white settlers, much less the Native American settlers who lived there. And now the end of coal is transforming it once again. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how this sense of an Appalachian homeland has been transformed through, you know, the centuries since the country has been founded.
That's a long and complicated question, isn't it? I can't claim to be an expert about Appalachia. The last few years, I have been going to the Appalachian Studies Association in an effort to learn more about the region and all its complexity. It's a wonderful association because it's not just literary or in the arts. It includes scholars and economic developers and ecologists and all kinds of people focused on the region in full or in part in their research. So I'm learning a lot about Appalachia. I mean, the broad strokes of the region have to do with energy extraction. That is, profiteers coming mainly from other places to extract the valuable mineral resources of the area and the profits went elsewhere. So, I mean, this is a recipe for economic disaster, and it has been a recipe for ecological disaster. And when coal has gotten more and more difficult to extract, we see, you know, the latter day effects of mountaintop removal, which is just an impossible set of words to even say. It involves destroying something as solid as a mountain and taking it down to a couple of football fields flatness. I mean, it's just, it's got awful. And I've even had people say to me, well, mountaintop removal creates flat lands and that people can use. And I'm like, wait a minute, you just destroyed a mountain. I wonder if I could read just like a paragraph from my book.
I would love that.
This is focused on coal extraction, but also on transforming that into something we can think about another way. If the shopworn biblical metaphor for the body is a temple, house of the spirit, then the world is the body of God. Take this world as house, each town and feature on the map. Explore these rooms one by one. I grew up in Richlands near Raven and Red Ash, not that far from Dante, pronounced Dant, Cedar Bluff and Jewel Ridge, among the Appalachian Mountains and along the Clinch River. The Appalachian region stretches across parts of 13 states, uniting north and south, and the Clinch River meanders down to Tennessee. The first thing I fished from those waters was a monster bearing rows of shark-like teeth. We called it a dogfish after the shark, but it was probably a catfish. Easily entertained, I learned early that anywhere makes a good place for a miracle, if you want to call it that. Now I tramp around my loft living room each morning in full view of the mountains to the north, east, and west, watching Norfolk Southern trains pull coal from seams and move any number of hidden things piled two shipping containers high in the opposite direction. Pick a room. Take a walk through the body of God.
That is so beautiful. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet and author Catherine Hankla about her book, Lost Places, on losing and finding home. One of the things that you say here is that when you lose your home, you lose your memory. But when you transform your home, what happens to memory? The way your home is being transformed now.
It's an interesting proposition because I think that the human body is scaled to place. I don't think we do so well disembodied. That is, when we change our location, it takes a while to adjust, even if we don't go very far. And that's why the memory palace works so well. The memory palace, memory house, being that imaginary space, a physical space imagined, and you put things you want to remember in it. Like you put your umbrella in the dining room chair after picturing the dining room. You put people around the table that you want to remember and that kind of thing. So I think we're geared to memory almost equaling place or equaling space. So it's very discombobulating for us. I think we've all had the experience of trying to find something after we've moved it two or three times, and we keep reimagining it in the place that we put it the first time. Okay, we know we've moved, and that thing has moved with us. But I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but I've had it many times to wake up in the middle of the night. It's like, where is the XYZ? And I have a perfect image of where it is, only I don't live there anymore.
I was just thinking about this yesterday because I'm moving things around in a room. My granddaughter is coming to stay for the summer. So I'm relocating things. And it, you know, did occur to me that now I have to try to remember where I put them, because in my mind, they live someplace where they were, not where they are.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think it's just the way our minds tend to want to work. I mean, and I would try to extend this idea to the Western landscape in thinking about ways in which, if one isn't familiar with the landscape, one can be lost. But if one is very familiar with the landscape, as the native peoples were, moving through land that, in which every feature of it had a name, they could not be lost. And I think that had a huge impact on me, just thinking about the human scale of all of that in the ancient world, in terms of people walking everywhere they went, which really made everything the same journey everywhere. I mean, every place was as hard or as easy to get to as any other place when you're walking around.
You write in the title essay, Lost Places, you write, and affinity for lost places seems to have been born in me like an ache for solitude. So you talk about on losing and finding home, but you also want to have some places that are home to be forever lost. This is a paradox.
Well, I think what I finally came to in that essay and thinking about Chaco culture over 25 years of visiting it, that I wanted some places to remain hard to find. That is, not exactly lost, but difficult to get to. I guess I have the attitude that not everything should be as easy as clicking a mouse, that there ought to be some experiences reserved for people who don't mind the difficulty.
Yeah, and the essay, Lost Places, is about Chaco Canyon, as you just said. It's also called the center place, or at least a part of it. So describe Chaco Canyon. I mean, you know, we only have a certain amount of time, but describe briefly what Chaco Canyon was for you.
Well, it was many different things. It has been many different things. And since the book has come out, I've actually been back there again. I was there for my birthday on the vernal equinox in March, and I was camping with a good friend of mine, and got up in the middle of the night to put the pop-up down so that we could get in line and be among the 100 people that were able to go into the park to see the sunrise through two aligned doorways at Casa Racanada. And again, being there means that it's not that easy. That is, you know, getting there is a difficult road journey, and getting up in the middle of the night is never fun, and it was 15 degrees and so on and so forth. But in order to see that light coming through that ruin, and these are the kinds of experiences that I've had repeatedly in choosing to go back and back to Chaco. But in terms of a connection there, a personal connection, it goes back to a trip west that I took when I was 17 and went across the country camping, mostly on the ground for a month with a group in a renovated school bus. And the word renovated could be taken very lightly. It was actually a retired school bus, and we got it up and running again. And on that trip, we went all the way across the country to California and then back by a slightly northern route. And I went through Colorado the first time, saw New Mexico for the first time, the Grand Canyon. But one of the things that impressed me a lot was Mesa Verde. I didn't go to Chaco on that trip. I didn't even know about Chaco, but I did experience Mesa Verde. I found Chaco by accident. I was told to go there by a ranger in a different national park. I was down in the Petrified Forest National Park. I still didn't know anything about Chaco, 1993. And the ranger and I started talking, and he said, "You seem like the kind of person who would want to go to Chaco." And I thought, well, I'm not doing anything else. I think I'll drive up there. And that started my trips and my thinking about the place. It's also the sort of place that you can return and return and return and always find something new and different. There are 10,000 years of overlaid inhabitants there, from pit houses to the Chacoan ruins above ground made with bricks from the area, clay-baked bricks from the area. It's the largest architectural ruin in this country. I don't know if it is in the world, but it's got to be close if it's not. It's a World Heritage Site. I think if something grabs you, it just grabs you, and Chaco has grabbed me and not let go.
I know what you mean. I went there nearly 40 years ago. That's the last time I was there. And it was the first time I was there. And at that time, there wasn't even really a visitor center.
Oh, I know.
It was the quietest place I've ever been. So quiet that I can still, in my mind's eye, still my mind's ear, I can still hear the beating of the wings of a bird that flew over me as I spent the night inside one of the dwellings there. It was a place that really seemed like magic.
Well, people have a lot of different ideas about Chaco. You know, some people think it's magic, and some people think it has kind of an evil spirit. Interesting to read all that, because I've never experienced the latter, only the magic. But I think whatever it is that you bring there gets intensified. That's kind of what I think happens there. It's also a dark sky park now, so it's got one of the most incredible skies in the nation.
One of the things you talk about, Catherine Hankla, in this book, Lost Places, on losing and finding home, is how places are overwritten with different layers of time. And came to me as I read this with such a shock of recognition, because I call this the palimpsest of time. I live in a house that was first built in when I was 18, and I was the first person to stay here. My parents built it. My mother lived here. I took care of her before she died. Now I live here. When my son was first born, this was the first place we brought him to. So I live in and among these memories, and it's something that really keeps me here. I find it hard to think of leaving. And this was something that came to me again and again on reading your book. Talk a little bit about your mother, you and your aunt. You mentioned before that you took care of them. Talk about how their connection to place and to you is so interwoven in this book.
I learned a lot from being with my mother on her journey. My aunt had a different journey. My aunt was always in such a good mood that she never explored things that were thorny. She was just received whatever you wanted to chat with her about with such a great listener. All the people who cared for her in the nursing home where my aunt lived were her buddies, because she just kind of opened herself to whatever was going on with them and got interested in all of their lives. My mother was a harder nut in her old age. She was not medicated in any way except for blood pressure medication. And so her journey to 98 plus, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, was not smooth. And I'd often go in to see her after I was exhausted from work, and she would be sitting there with a pinched expression, and she would come out with some metaphysical problem she was having. So, you know, it's like I was completely unprepared for these questions. And the main one that my mother would keep asking is, why am I still here? And of course, she had to, you know, think about where she was physically, with her body failing, her mind remaining sharp. She often remarked when she looked in the mirror, she didn't know who was staring back because she felt just the same as always, but she looked so shockingly different to herself. She didn't recognize herself, on and on and on. I mean, it was just like a daily dose of existentialism in my mother, you know? So, I mean, a lot of the things that I was thinking about in the book, I was forced to think about them through these questions. You know, I'd be walking in there with toilet paper literally in my hands because she needed a new carton of toilet paper. And one day I walked in there with it, and she's lying on the floor looking up at me, and she's been there for several hours. And she, the first words out of her mouth are, "I'm so disgusted with myself." So anyway, I mean, it was, it changed me a lot. It made me much more open, patient, aware of all the things that I didn't know, couldn't do, had no way to fix. I think it made me responsible in a way that dovetailed with helplessness. It's a kind of it's a tough spot to be in, a caretaker.
Yes, I know that one well. And she also had a recurrent dream that was about trying to find her way home.
Oh, yes. Yes, that was one of those afternoon greetings that became a series. One day I walked in and she goes, "Oh, I've had that dream again." I was like, "What dream? You haven't told me about that before." She's like, "Oh yeah, I was trying to find home." And it would always be over some landscape that was unforgiving, and she's tracking and trekking, trying to find home. And since my mother and my father also were both, they love playing golf. So often the settings of these dreams would be like endless golf courses in which she's looking not for her ball, but looking for a home. And then one day I walked in there and she just looked at me and she said, "I found it." I'm like, "Oh no, mother's losing it." My first thought, I'm like, "Yeah, what did you find?" She goes, "I finally got there. I got home." And it just chilled me to the bone because I had to sit down, and she said, "Yeah, I finally found the house. They were all there. The light was on. They were all glad to see me." And I knew at that moment that it wouldn't be that much longer for her to die, because it just went through me that when you make it home in that dream, you're almost there.
Yes, my mother used to talk about her parents coming to visit her and greeting her, you know, who of course are long gone. And I also knew that it wasn't going to be that much longer. You know, there's so many different kinds of ways that you talk about home in this book. I mean, you built a home with your partner of about 10 years, a loft, that was painful to read at some points. It was
painful and funny. Yeah,
exactly. You know, you talk about living in the countryside, living in a neighborhood that you felt, you know, you were kind of a pioneer of gentrification in that neighborhood, and it was a difficult one. Tell us a little bit more about that first move that you made from the country to the city to be in this neighborhood, and what it was like to be in a place that wasn't all that much really home to you.
Yeah, that was that move was really difficult for me. I had been in the country for 12 years, and I had been trying to get to the country for over 20 years. I finally got there when I divorced, and then lived where I had wanted to live for a while. But being in the country was such a healing place for me on the whole, just because I needed that kind of removal. But when my partner and I got together, it was clear that she lived in the city. Her house was too small for both of us. My house was too small for both of us, and two dogs that didn't like each other. And so we started looking for a house, which I pretty much realized was going to bring me into the city. I was almost 40 minutes away. So we chose this very transitional neighborhood, and a high Victorian house, which was a painted lady. I think there were 16 colors on the house. It was definitely a house that an artist would choose. But it proved pretty impractical for us to fit our lives into. And I wrote about that in Neighborhood of Desire, where I'm also talking about trying to, as a middle-aged person, make a new life with another person very established in her field. So I'm an artist and a writer coming together in this high Victorian house with two dogs that really didn't like each other at all. So it was one of the most difficult periods of my life. I was kind of torn from my solitude into trying to figure out how to collaborate with another human being again. And because I had lived alone for 12 years after being married for 10 years. So I think in retrospect, it was just so awful at times that the only recourse was high hilarity. but to recognize that the place was so difficult in itself. We were surrounded by people whose lives were just so chaotic. And right next door to us, we had a very dysfunctional family of grandchildren and being raised by their grandmother. The backyard filled with trash. Everything about them was in violation of something. And we were trying to live next to that and using and treating our house like a beautification project. So we were always in a state of high irony, you know, with whatever was going on around us in that neighborhood. But at the same time, I mean, it really stretched me in ways that I needed to be stretched. And we did survive that neighborhood as a couple, which really surprised me. It was actually the much more grandiose loft that did us in.
Yeah, and that's not that unusual for couples. When they take on a major renovation project, it can torpedo a relationship.
Yeah, I think having survived the transitional Victorian house, I felt emboldened in ways I should not have.
Catherine Hankla. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about her memoir, Lost Places, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending most of the hour with poet, novelist, and essayist Catherine Hankla talking about her book, Lost Places, On Losing and Finding Home. It's a memoir taken from her essays written over years. Just before the break, we were talking about the renovation of a downtown loft that Hankla did with her partner, a renovation that led ultimately to their breakup. And what is it about that process? You know, this is a book about finding and losing, you know, losing and finding home. What do you think it is about the process of renovating a house that can so often lead to destroying a home rather than creating one?
Oh, yes. We left such a pretty space behind us. You know, the tensions mount, and we had a particularly difficult project. I write about that in Dream House. But I don't know that we ever really lived there happily. We both appreciated the thing that we were able to make. This loft was built in an old office building that hadn't been occupied for about 15 years. And so the whole thing was gutted. There was nothing there. So we had to draw up a plan for this entire floor of an office building that became our home. And that part of it was not as difficult as actually working through all the layers of contract and the builder, the developer, the all the layers of legal, this and that. And at the time, we were kind of properly blind to all of this. It's sort of like when you go into a marriage, you know, marriage is about love and divorce is about property. So we were just kind of in love with the process, and we didn't pay that much attention to all the legalities when we started. And we were much more seeing it as a creative project. And there really wasn't that much tension between us as we worked through the different decisions, multitudes of decisions that had to do with designing and building a space. I think what set in afterwards might have been like two versions of PTSD after the fact. and then, you know, life doesn't stop when you're involved in a huge project like this. We were both under various stresses from family and work. And so I think somehow achieving the thing makes you more vulnerable to losing it.
Right. Yes, I understand that. So I wanted to ask you a question, something that's puzzled me for a long time and came up to my mind as I was reading this book, Lost Places, Catherine Hankla. You know, I spent 8 months at a certain point in my life, about almost 20 years ago, in Provence, in southern France, not on the coast, inland. And I really felt that I had found home. This was my home. And yet, when I left there, I have not ever been back. And I may go back, but I doubt that it's ever going to be my actual home. And yet, I still feel that that is my home. I wonder how you might interpret that. Is that something that you've ever felt, that a place is home to you that isn't a place that you live?
Well, you were living there when you felt that, right?
Right. Well, when I discovered that, but I still feel that way. I feel it's my home, even, and I don't even have to live there to feel that way.
Right, right. I guess it depends on the answer that I would give. That depends on whether or not somebody believes in past lives, because I think that furnishes one explanation for parts of us fitting into place. It's almost like we have gone home again because we've lived a life there at some point in time. And I think a lot of people believe that because there's really no other explanation for these profound feelings of connection to a place. So that's one way that we can think about that. I think also home might be a proportion. That is, there's a certain proportion there that maybe it has a similarity to the landscape that's etched on you in childhood that you don't have to analyze to know that that's there.
Well, I'm not sure I believe in past lives, and I never have lived in a place quite like that. But nonetheless, I guess in some ways it's that home can be an imagined country. Or I guess what I'm thinking about is the intersection between a physical place and a place of the imagination. And that is something that you write about in this book.
Yeah, I think to some degree home is always imagined. Either we're looking back at home as the most familiar way that people think of it, that home is back there somewhere. In other words, we're remembering it, and every time we remember it, we're imagining that. So it does have this sort of ethereal quality to it over time, so that it becomes an imaginary like concept, something that we're moving toward or away from is very common as well. You know, leaving home is also important. Losing home, leaving home, just being displaced from home in various ways, you know, finding our own way, leaving behind values that are too constricting to us, or, you know, finding constriction if we had too much looseness. I mean, people go both ways with this. But I do think that we feel connected with certain places. Obviously, Provence is beautiful. It probably stimulated your sensory connection in certain ways that are profound.
And so say a little bit more about losing home and what that allows you to do. What, you know, I think when we think we're unmoored, well, that seems to be a negative. But as you just said, sometimes we have to do that.
Yeah, I think we avoid it as best we can. But then sometimes we seek it as well. I think there's always a consequence one way or the other. One way in which I have felt very unmoored in my adult life, even though I still live in the same region that I grew up in, has been displacement from relationships and also having parents and other family members die, that there's a displacement away from things we feel comfortable with when people leave us to this world and they're not in it anymore. I think it really rearranges your molecules when your parents die. You know, the first one goes and you start kind of redefining yourself in relationship to that loss and also to that person, redefining the relationship, which does indeed go on in some way, even though half of the conversation is over, you think, but then it has a tendency to reinvent itself in different ways. So I think that losing home to me recently has been losing my mother, who died after my book was finished and didn't get to read it. And she was an amazing reader. She was, you know, still reading up until the day before she was sick in bed, the last day of her life, and the only time she was sick in bed. I was so grateful for that. But when you're taking care of someone for a long time and they're utmost in your thoughts, when you're no longer doing that, you have to reinvent yourself and reimagine your life in certain ways. So I think it's ongoing. And that's really why I call the book On Losing and Finding Home. Not that one ever arrives, but that it's a cyclical way that we live.
Ah, so not on losing home and finding home, but on losing and finding home.
Exactly. I do think it's a cycle that we all go through, you know, feeling unmoored, feeling moored. And sometimes we think, you know, we've reached the pinnacle of whatever happiness, and then something happens and the rug gets kicked out from under us and we start again.
Right. And that makes me think of there's a part in the book in which you say that more and more you write to express faith in life in its unfolding, which is a very beautiful thing to say.
It's very true for me in the way in which this book connected with my life. Made it difficult to end the book. I couldn't figure out where to end the book, but I think it ended in a logical place.
Well, it is a beautiful book and very beautifully written. Lost Places on Losing and Finding Home. Catherine Hanklis, thank you so much for talking with us about this book.
Well, I really enjoyed talking with you, and I can tell you're connected with the book, and that makes me very happy.
I thought our interview was done, but then noticed that we had time for Catherine Hanklis to read us another passage from her book, Lost Places, and she graciously agreed to do so.
Every night for a number of years, a woman slept next to me for at least some part of those hours. She said Sunday nights felt achy before we moved in together. One night, in the historic house of many colors, a waterfall rippled down a 20-foot wall above the grand staircase below the complicated roof. There had been a drought for a while, but after we moved into the house, it began to rain. A few days earlier, some workmen had removed a long-dead bird from a roof crevasse. It was nothing but tiny bones and a few lousy feathers stuck together. No identity left. What a blessing, I thought, when the rotted bird was removed. But apparently it had been sealing the roof from leaks. It took gallons and gallons of viscous black goo and a team of roofers to do what the wedged bird had done by itself, weighing nearly nothing and accidentally applied to the weak spot by the pressure and ingenuity of the rain's hands.
So what do you make of that?
I think that was about the High Victorian House of Many Colors that I write about more in Neighborhood of Desire. I think that old houses really have their own stories, right? And they're kind of put together with spit and glue. They're overwritten by having lots of different people occupying them. And that house in particular had been renovated with quotation marks around the word at many different points. But it definitely had stories to tell. You know, at one point we were looking behind one of the mantles in the house that had two beautiful mantles with the green man carved on them. And I found some old brittle newspaper and was getting ready to pitch it away. And I looked down at the newspaper and there was the name of my ex-husband's father, an ad in the Roanoke Times for his legal services. So the house, you know, had many different lives, and our brief time there, our 3 years there, was only just a small part of it.
Well, Catherine Hanklis, thank you so much for reading that and talking with us.
Okay, wonderful. So nice to talk to you. Really enjoyed it.
Catherine Hanklis teaches English at Hollins University, where she directs the Jackson Center for Creative Writing. She's been honored with numerous awards, including a Penn Syndicated Fiction Award. As you heard in this interview, I spent a sojourn in Provence and felt that I had found my true home there. Now I realize one can have several true homes, and I live in one of them, but Provence is also still one of them for me. I wrote a memoir about my time in Provence soon after I returned, which I call Province of the Heart. Then I set it aside for many years. I've now come back to it, thanks to a writing group at my local library. Here's a passage from the last chapter, titled Finding Home. I woke at dawn. I had slept fitfully, thinking of my impending departure. I pulled on my shoes, took up my walking staff one last time, and headed out the door as the cat Poutine scurried past my feet into the house, looking for breakfast after a long night out. The sky was a limpid blue, with ropey trails of pink and gray-tinged clouds. The ground was dry, even at that hour, and the stony earth commented on my passing, while the wind sighed regretfully in the trees that bordered the village. As I descended the plateau, I heard a duet of cuckoos calling to each other across the valley in contrapuntal harmony, bidding me mark the time. The church bells of the neighboring commune struck the half hour, 6:30. Sheep bells chimed from across the valley as if in answer. They rang on the air like water tumbling over the stones of a forest stream, becoming more distinct as I brushed past clumps of flowering thyme, browsed by noisy bumblebees, past a patch of broadleafed sage heavy with pale mauve blooms, past tall bushes of eglantine with their withered ornaments of overwintered berries, and through a field of lavender with its plump gray-green foliage. Buttercups lined the path. Wild poppies splashed their red splendor against the rocky verdure of the landscape. I glanced back toward the village. Golden in the first rays of the sun, it looked like a fabled city in a tale of long ago. An early rising fly buzzed my ear, and songbirds warmed up their voices with crepuscular twitters. A mourning dove sounded its urgent plaint, while a neighbor's rooster declared the day. A hunting dog bayed a lonely greeting from his pen at the edge of the village. Sound is the marker of place. It was Sunday morning in Provence, my last day before the journey to the airport in Nice and the flight home. I returned to the house for a demi-tasse of sweet, dark coffee and one of the grocer's Madame Pascal's croissants, together with my host Fabienne on the terrace. The sheep bells sounded closer, and it wasn't long before I spied the shepherd Hervé slowly making his way with his flock up the slope to the village. I ran out to say goodbye. "You're going home now?" he asked me. "Yes," I sighed, although I had hoped I could buy a home here to come back to. I didn't want to sound too self-pitying. "Provence is the home of my heart," I continued, "but it's not where I live. I love my friends and family. I wouldn't want to live too far from them. And I am an American. I know how to get along there." I trailed off, thinking of returning to the ease of a place where everything was in English and I knew the ropes. "But I don't know if there is really a home for me there, and evidently there's no home for me here either." "You will find your home," Hervé assured me. "I know you will. I don't know where, but it will be the right home for you." Then we kissed each other on both cheeks, as the French do, hands clasped in farewell. "It was really important that we met each other," Hervé said, giving my hands a little squeeze for emphasis. I looked at him quizzically, but he didn't elaborate. Then he called to his faithful dog Tango to round up the sheep, sang out the word he used to summon them, "Prête," and followed their parade to the next pasture. The art of living. That's something the French are so famous for that it's usually expressed in French, l'art de vivre. I became a willing apprentice in this art, whose goal is happiness. And in between the delightful catechisms of artisanal gastronomy and convivial conversation, I could not but wonder why Americans seem so unhappy. I am, of course, making a gross generalization, but like all such, it is to elicit what our society fosters or discourages. Americans have an international reputation for glad-handed friendliness, but their friendliness is all too often only skin deep. Underneath the seemingly jovial surface, you quickly encounter the hard concrete of suspicion. Foreigners mistake the American habit of familiarity for intimacy. But we are a distant lot. We tend our barriers assiduously. My friends from Provence, in contrast, seem to have few barriers, either to generosity or to a genuine sharing of perspective and reflection. Conversation was like the food, rich, varied, and something you could sink your teeth into. And food was honored as much for being the lubricant for conversation as for its own pleasurable qualities. Celebration of food and friends expresses the heart of the French gospel, the core of the good life. My friend's embrace reminded me to pay attention to the bedrock upon which humans have always built our lives. We all value and want the same things: a congenial home, good food, time spent with friends and family, the sense that we are part of a community, a balance between work and play, and appreciation of the natural world and our place in it. On the small-scale human level of village life, I rediscovered these values at work in a way that I had despaired of ever seeing. Not confined to an alternative lifestyle, but placed at the center of society. We human beings have evolved on the same basis of cooperation that is the essential warp and woof of village life. The lone hunter, the model of the rugged individualist, is a social Darwinist myth. The hunter brought down his prey to feed not just himself, or even just his immediate family, but his village, and before that his tribe, and he usually hunted in concert with others. Perhaps the most important advantage to human evolution was the grandmother, who watched the children with the other grandmothers while the parents were out getting food for the group. The human village is encoded in the genes. When I found myself living in one, it was no wonder that it felt like home.
Allez, mère, allez. Passe, 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 passe. Avance, avance, avance. Prrté. Avance, avance.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.